views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and this is Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Today, we are going to talk about the United States economy and the global economy. It's not doing that great, as all of us know who's been following it. And today, my guest, Irvin Goldman, is an expert at knowing what's going on in Wall Street. He ran the strategy. He was the head of strategy for JP Morgan Chase, which most of you know is one of the world's largest banks. And then he was also the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, which he took from pretty much a devastated company. After 2011, two-thirds of the people that were employees at Cantor Fitzgerald died in the World Trade Centers, and he rebuilt that company. And he also set them up as one of the small or one of the few dealers with the Federal Reserve. There's only a very small list of banks or companies that deal with the Federal Reserve, and he was able to set that up. So he knows what's going on internally with the Federal Reserve and also with the big banks strategy-wise. And if you heard about the problems that J.P. Morgan had just a few years ago where they lost $6 billion in derivatives, he was heavily involved in that as well. So he has some pretty good insights. And our discussion today will really go deep into many facets of the U.S. economy and the world economy. So now I'm going to welcome Irvin Goldman to the program. Hi, Irvin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, sir.
You have quite the experience. You managed a $350 billion fund at J.P. Morgan right in the middle of 2008 to 2012, right in the middle of the calamity that we were all going through, the storm. How do you compare what you had to go through then to what's going on now in the market?
Well, they were very different times. First of all, just to clarify, I was there from J.P. Morgan from 2008 for a period of 1 year. Then I took a year off, and then I went back in 2010.
So okay.
I missed the 2009 period. And I was head of strategy for the group, and it's a very different time. Clearly, when I was there, it was right in the aftermath of the financial crisis. The markets were very dislocated. There was a lot of distress in the system. And now we're dealing with the knock-on effects of having gone through the crisis and this great monetary experiment we're going through, which, in my opinion, without it, we would have been living in the Great Depression, not talking about the 1930s.
Are you talking about the QE and printing money and all that?
Yeah, absolutely. The global monetary expansion throughout the world. Yes,
yeah, absolutely. Just creating more dollars everywhere.
More currency everywhere, because you had the Japanese Central Bank, the ECB, which is still going through quantitative easing phase, and the Federal Reserve all easing. So it was a synchronized global easing, part of which is still going on.
And that was to try to get more money out to the system, because we had a seize of credit, right? And businesses could not get money. And by doing that, do you think it flowed out to the Main Street businesses that really desperately needed that?
Partially. I mean, the stimulus was tremendous, but what always happens in any type of financial crisis is that, you know, the pendulum swings. So we swang from really easy money to extremely tight money. And the big beneficiaries, I think, in terms of the lower interest rates and the increased liquidity was financial institutions and wealthy Americans who had great credit. I think it's still taking time for that liquidity to make it to Main Street.
So you don't think it's made it there really in big amounts yet?
Not as much as I think it should.
Yeah. Well, do you think the market is fragile today, or do you think we're fairly robust?
No, I think the market is quite fragile, and there's a sense of stability that's come from the rise in the equity markets, particularly in the United States. And I feel like the global economy is still not stable. And although our growth has started to slow a little bit, and we've just been growing at a moderate pace, subpar for what is normal in a recovery, there are tremendous problems throughout the globe, both from a recovery standpoint, as well as from just general economic stabilization and restructuring going on in various countries. So the emerging markets are particularly weak right now. We all know, we see it every day about that China's slowing down, and we're starting to continue to see those effects in some of the earnings numbers that are coming out, because you see it in companies like that have exposure to China and how much they're slowing down.
Well, you hear there's with the internet today, it's a different world. It really is. And you hear people talk about there's doom and gloom where the world's coming to an end, kind of. And then there's the other spectrum that you know, things will be great forever. And I think that there's the reality is usually a little more complicated than that. It's usually not that way. But, you know, the IMF and other large institutions are starting to talk that there's going to be a global recession and that the markets are really tough. So we're starting to hear that talk from the mainstream. And do you think that's going to affect the United States, or do you think we're going to be able to just kind of plod along lower than not doing that great, meaning we'd like to grow faster, but not be affected by that to a point of where we go into a deep recession?
So I think that the probability that we'll go into a recession next year, in my view, is probably 20 to 25%. And it's not because of what's going on in the U.S. economy. It's the fact that the U.S. economy is part of a globally interconnected world. And there are issues. You have the second largest economy in the world, where there really isn't transparency about how much it's declining. And that makes the environment very uncertain because, you know, we see what's going on with China's stock market and the unprecedented intervention that the government has come in to make, which, quite frankly, is going to forestall people's confidence in the capital markets in China.
Well, China's been doing weird things. The amount they're building all those ghost cities and they're spending. They use more concrete in the last decade than we've used in the last century. I mean, they've just been growing like crazy without a means to use it.
Right. So the real question is quantifying the correction that they're going through from that overbuilding, that overstimulation, and they really are going through a transition where they're in their economy in what they're trying to achieve in terms of structural reform. But that takes time. And, you know, it's interesting because the Chinese have a much longer time frame of doing things than, quite frankly, Western countries and Western investment community and so on and so forth. So I think they will get it right over time. I just think they're going through some dramatic changes, and it takes time, and nothing happens without bumps in the road. And I think we're seeing a bump in the road. I'm personally long-term very constructive on China.
Well, I think that I think they has a lot of possibilities too. I think they could get to the point where they're more the dominant figure long-term. But do they, when you're thinking they think long-term, when they were doing all this construction and so forth, do you think that was planned out? I mean, you can't not do that and not plan it out.
Yeah. I do think it was planned out. I think it was, a policy, and the policy just went too far. It's just simple.
It's the pendulum swing again.
Yeah.
They just overdid it.
It's exactly that. It's no different.
Can't pull them back.
The pendulum swing that we saw, right? I mean, with the subprime lending and everything, it's like, you know.
The herd is going too fast that way. You got to pull them back before they hurt themselves.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, do you think, you know, there's been people are throwing around this notion of a currency reset for the U.S. dollars because we're in a situation where with all the debt and all the printing and everything else that we have to just at some point just reset the whole system. Do you think that is something that could happen or needs to happen?
I don't. I actually think that would be bad now. Right. I mean, the globe is relatively unstable. The dollar is the world reserve currency. I don't think that's going to change in the medium term. In the long term, it may change. There's a number of things going on. So you see the devaluations going on in various countries, a lot of them in emerging markets, but basically across the globe against the dollar.
Currency wars going on. I mean, wars aren't done necessarily militarily. They're also done, you know, based on currency and cyber wars and all these other things.
Right. Well, so in my view, basically the world needs to leverage off of the U.S. growth, right? We're trying to get the whole global financial system to recover from the crisis. And just like the easing of monetary policy occurred at different times, the recovery is occurring at different times. And the world has been leveraging off U.S. growth. And I think in order for those other countries to become competitive, one of the ways to do it, since there's no more lowering of interest rates left, you know, the next mechanism is to create growth through a weaker currency. And that's what we see going on. So I think there's a difference between competitive devaluation that I think actually will help global growth over time.
So you mean that the currencies compared to the dollar are a lot weaker? Because our dollar is pretty strong. So they're doing that to increase their growth.
Right. So therefore, when we go to buy something, their goods are cheaper now, and therefore we'll buy more from them.
You are listening to Business Game Changers, and we need to take a short station break. Welcome back to Business Game Changers, and I'm talking with Irvin Goldman, and we will continue the interview now.
And therefore, since we're growing, we're the demand.
Is that the song when your phone rings?
That is the song when my phone. That is the
that's
song.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry. That's song. That's actually the particular song. There he goes. I got to shut that off. That is the particular song. I'm sliding the power off. Sorry.
I had a friend that was in a board meeting, and her
her son or daughter, I don't remember, one of her kids changed it to like a hard rock song or something, and it rang, and she's looking, she was so embarrassed. It's funny. I think that's awesome.
Okay, so I have a song, right? I have favorites, right? So I have like 12 favorites, and I have a different song for each kid, my wife, my parents, my brother, my best friends, and you know,
you use it for real. You use it how it's supposed to be used.
I totally use it. So Happy is my youngest son.
That's good. Well, okay. Well, let's get back to a more serious topic. Do you think when we edited the Federal Reserve, we learned that there was $16 trillion that was being funneled during that time period into foreign banks? Do you think that the Federal Reserve should be audited again so that we can have transparency in this market or what's going on? Because that, if something goes awry with that, the U.S. people are on the hook for it.
Right. So I do not believe that we should politicize the Fed. And unfortunately, the way our government's structured and the partisan nature of politics, I just think there's two parts of the Fed. One is its monetary policy arm, and the other is its regulatory arm.
Yes.
I actually think that the regulatory arm could use some oversight and perhaps more, but I do not think that politicians should get involved in any way in monetary policy. I think it needs to be independent.
Yeah, but who makes the decision? It's like a company's budget. You know, who makes a decision on what the budget should be? And in some ways, that's what the Federal Reserve can do. If they can print money, they make the decision on what the United States budget is to a large extent.
Well, you know, it's interesting because they could set parameters, right? Which, like, you know, if you look at the Basel rules, right? Basically, what they're meant to do is to put constraints upon which a particular bank has to meet those constraints, because otherwise they're deemed to be imprudent. Congress actually has that ability because the Federal Reserve was created by Congress, right? So it has the ability, if it wants to put certain parameters around it that could be very large, but also it could maintain the Fed from potentially going over its skis with the balance sheet, right? It could do that. That's different than, you know, putting rules is different than constantly auditing them, questioning them.
Sure.
Having impact.
And that makes sense. Different. So, but is there a way that there can be more of an oversight without it being political, you know, almost like the Supreme Court is?
I haven't seen someone come up with a good structure for that, and it would scare the hell out of me personally to see Congress have any influence to a large degree over.
Is it because they're so ignorant to monetary policy and it's such a quagmire?
Well, I think the approval ratings of Congress, you know, demonstrate the country's confidence in their abilities. So,
yes. Well, okay. So with your experience in Wall Street, do you think that regulations, and maybe you already answered this, but do you think regulations should be increased or just enforced? Because there's a lot that goes on, and it's like with this last crisis, nothing happened to anyone. And I can imagine there was a lot of fraud there, but it didn't seem like anyone went to jail and there was no enforcement.
Right. So I have, this is a topic we could do a whole show on.
But I'm sure. And I might have you back for that one.
Okay. In general, you know, this is a complex topic. So from my standpoint, I think that the biggest regulatory mistake that was made was the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And I think that one of the great solutions to the financial crisis we just experienced would have been to put Glass-Steagall back in force. I think Dodd-Frank is in essence a very complex, incomplete set of rules that
it just doesn't get the job done.
It doesn't get the job done. And in fact, I think the balance of it, meaning that I think it goes way too far in certain ways and it doesn't go enough in other ways. Now, you know, let me just go back to one thing you said, which was about, you know, the fraud and the fact that there was no criminal prosecution.
Well, I mean, there was right? some basic stuff, just like Wells Fargo doing the robo-signing on...
No, I don't think... I think, unfortunately, that is the one area where, you know, it's tough being a financial executive saying this.
I know, but I want your opinion because you were in the inside.
I actually think that part is wrong. I think more people should have been held responsible for what they did, and I think, quite frankly, a lot more people should have gone to jail.
Well, no,
because I do think there was an enormous amount of fraud, inappropriate, illegal behavior, and, you know, one of the problems you have with a lot of this is just the way the system works, right? So, you know, these prosecutors go after executives at banks, right? And the banking community and the executives are particularly wealthy and hire the absolute best lawyers in the entire world, and armies of them.
Yes.
And it's just very difficult, I think, given that state of legal defense and the opaque nature of some of the rules, for them to really nail down people. The other thing that I think is, really important, and this goes for both regulators as well as the justice system, is, you know, they use lawyers, accountants, and other types of professionals who really don't have any experience in the business that they're going after. And a lot of it has to do with financial reasons. People don't go typically from Wall Street to government, right? And they don't go from Wall Street to legal firms, right? So what happens is you have...
They do, but not in the ranks. They do it at the top levels, right? But not at the...
Where all the work gets done, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. They don't do it where all the work gets done. So I think that they're always at a disadvantage. And, you know, it's a little bit like the criminal justice system. It's just, you see so many examples of where if people, wealthy people, have an advantage over somebody that's not wealthy in terms of what actually happens to them. And a lot of it has to do with the defense system, right? So it's the reality. It's just the wealth and the defense. If you look at all the legal budgets of all these major banks, they're astonishing.
Yeah,
astonishing, and I don't know how the government gets around that, because it's one thing not to have the money; it's another thing not to really have the expertise to go in and to prosecute people coming from the perspective of, okay, I know exactly how you operate, I know exactly what you do. It just doesn't exist. So,
well, the sad part is that criminals mess it up for everyone.
They do.
They, I mean, they really do. I mean, even on like a basic level, if you get rid of a bad apple, and I think everybody has seen this as a manager, you get rid of a bad apple, and then suddenly everything starts to go back to normal and starts working again, on a team. And you know that's how dysfunctional a criminal can be to any working environment. Imagine that all through the system and knowing that they're immune because they have powerful attorneys and have wealth. It's a major problem.
Right. No, it's a problem. I think the culture of Wall Street itself itself lends itself to an unhealthy environment.
We have to take a short station break. We'll be back in a moment. Hello, we are back with Business Game Changers on the Transformation Talk Radio Network and Conscious Business Radio, and we are continuing our interview now.
Do you think that regular people can trust their investments in the market?
Trust them.
Can they trust the market that it'll be safe with the environment that's out there now?
Actually, one of the interesting things about the regulation, and this gets back to Glass-Steagall, is I actually think the classic banks, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, are financially much, much stronger than they were before. So I think the banking system is stronger. I think the real thing that's happened is from Dodd-Frank, you know, before with Glass-Steagall, there was a separation of what a bank could do and what an investment bank could do. A bank borrowed money, lent it to individuals, corporations, and governments. Plain vanilla business, they take credit risk. You know, it's been going on forever. Then you had investment banks who make markets, take risk, and provide liquidity to the market. And I think that if we were to go back to that, the markets in general would be better off.
And they put it in place during the Great Depression, and then we had pretty stable markets until they took it out of existence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I personally just think it should go back. I have a very strong feeling. Because if you, you know, let's take a look at one of the biggest causes of the financial crisis, right? So you had this investment banking arm that was creating these derivative securities, these subprime securities.
Well, derivatives are a problem too, right?
Yeah.
Now, with putting that back in place, would that solve the derivative issue?
I think it curtails the distribution of derivatives. So what I mean by that, and let me just give you an example, is that in the era of the buildup of the subprime market, right, what happened is basically the investment banks got tremendous fees for creating these securities. So they were very incentivized to create these derivative securities. And then what happened is, in creating them, there's one part of them, one piece of the derivatives that's the riskiest. And you have to sell that to sell the security.
Oh, you sell the whole thing.
Right. So that you could sell the whole thing. Right. So what happened was the banking arm of the same institution would buy the risky pieces, right? So that the investment banking arm would make all the money by creating the securities and selling them to customers. And that's why the banks got loaded up with all these securities all over the world of, you know, these highly volatile explosives.
Which they wouldn't have bought if they were separate.
Exactly.
That makes sense. They just wouldn't buy a product like that, but if they're owned and intertwined, then they do.
Well, it's sort of like, okay, let's take this. I can make a tremendous amount of money by selling X part, but I have to somehow sell Y. So I just take Y and put it on my, you know, on my shelf, because I have this shelf known as a bank over here, and because they were making so much money selling X, and it helped their earnings and helped their stock, and everybody was getting rich off it. Then, you know, eventually it came to roost, and it destroyed the whole banking system.
Well, and we still could have problems today with that, correct? I mean, that could still come up and rear its ugly head.
Right. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to limit the amount of the percentage that banks can hold of various types of securities. And that's the way they're going around it. But that gets back to the argument of, you know, Glass-Steagall, you know, takes
the incentive away.
It's almost like simplifying the tax code, right? It's like Glass-Steagall just makes it simple. You can do this and somebody else can do that.
So without putting that back in place, we really aren't solving the problem.
I think that the new regulation has solved a lot of problems. It hasn't solved all the problems. And I think the problems are quite complex. And, you know, the other problem with regulation is you have different types of regulation in different countries of the world. It's not a globally consistent regulatory framework.
Yeah, it makes it complex, doesn't it?
Very.
Well, okay, let's talk about gold and silver, because that's really been a hot thing with everybody. And it's really heavily manipulated. And because the demand for gold and silver is higher than the supply right now. People are waiting 6-8 weeks for it. They're paying huge, you know, dealer prices to get it. Do you think that gold and silver will ever rise according to demand?
Yes, I do.
When do you think and how will that happen? I mean, they have to get rid of that manipulation.
Right. So, you know, this gets back to your global currency reset story, right? Because I don't believe that any other country is necessarily going to get the credibility of the same credibility the United States has for a long time. Now, clearly, reserves.
I would agree with that.
So, reserves have changed. I mean, the euro has increased to 21% of all global reserves. But in order to do what the IMF is suggesting, which is creating an SDR, some form of a basket, I think it's got to be backed by gold. And I think if that happens, what you will see is you will continue to see the central banks of the world continuing to buy gold. And I think you see China doing that. I mean, it's interesting. I think there are a lot of people that believe that right now what's happened is that given the financial crisis, that a lot of central banks have sold their reserves for a form of liquidity.
And what do you think?
I do think that's the case. And I do think, I think gold should be part of someone's portfolio. I think you should have gold as a percentage allocation to your portfolio.
Well, it's a piece of insurance, if nothing else, right? Because it's not, at this point, it can't really lose value because it's at the point of what it costs to mine it and to produce it.
Well, it could lose value.
You think it'll go below what the cost to produce it and distribute it?
You just never know with markets, right?
That's true. You're right with that. I've been around long enough to know that that's true. Right. But I can't see gold going below the cost to mine it and distribute it.
You would think not, but you know, I've seen issues. You know, it's really interesting. I've seen instances where people buy treasury bills that are deliverable at a future date, so they know when they're going to sell it. So basically, the treasury bill at a point in the future will equal the futures price, and then the treasury bill actually drops to levels that are inconsistent with the fact that you could actually just sell it in the future at this price. Therefore, it shouldn't be at the price it is.
It just doesn't make sense.
And it doesn't make sense, and it's put people out of business, right? So that's just part of the way financial markets work.
Well, okay, but let's get back to gold a little bit. If some of these central banks are selling their gold with countries like China just buying it in hordes, that puts them in a pretty strong position.
Listen, I think there's no question that over time that China and the United States will have the same economic clout. And at some point in, you know, we won't necessarily be alive at that point, but I think China will actually be the dominant country in the world. And I think global demographics are going to have a lot to do with that.
Well, and there's other things too. Their whole education system, they just, anybody who's been to college in the last 40 years, or I work at a university, it's pretty amazing. Some of these Asian students that come in and how serious they are about education. And, you know, we have pockets of families here that are very serious, but as a society and as a culture, we're nowhere near how seriously they take it. And I just can't see how over time that can't be, let alone their numbers and gold and everything else they have going on. Just that one fundamental cultural thing, I can't see how that wouldn't play a major role.
Well, I think that'll play a major role. I think the one element that is going on behind the scenes of the whole global economy is the global demographic changes. And one is the aging of population. And the second is basically the mix of the population over time. It's actually interesting, but right now, Africa is only 8% of the world's population.
Interesting. And what is Asia?
Hold on. Let me finish.
Okay, you're going to get to that.
I'll get to it.
To the punchline.
Okay, so I'll give you both the statistics. But in 2050, which is 35 years from now, Africa will be 21% of the world's population.
Wow. Growing very quickly.
Very quickly. And the reason is, A, they're young, right? They have a tremendous birth-death rate. And right now you see birth-death rates in developing countries declining pretty rapidly. So
sure. As their
answering your question
better.
About Asia, though, Asia presently has 55% of the world's population, right? And in 2050, it will only have 57%, which is just a 2% increase. So it's not going to be growing as a greater percentage of the world. The issue is the world's going to be growing, so it's still a huge number.
Well, right? their wealth is growing as percentage, right? If you looked at the percentage of wealth that they'll have in 35 years, or isn't it 35 years you're talking? I would imagine their percentage of wealth would be a lot higher than it is now.
It's going to be, yeah. So you were right. I'm just saying that I'm not disagreeing with your original premise. I'm just saying there's another factor going on in the globe, which is the aging, right? So how productive are economies, right? You could have a large economy, but quite frankly, if a vast majority of your population, or 25% or more, which is going to happen in the United States, obviously, and in most developing countries, is 65 and older, and plus people are living longer, it puts tremendous strains on those countries' social security systems, if you will, and their healthcare systems.
Well, and
tremendous.
We don't have as many children.
It's not all about population.
Right? And we just don't have the children that, because we're a much more educated system, we just don't have the same amount of children we used to either, right? I mean, the average number of children per couple is what, 1.9, 2.1, something like that?
It's 2.1, but it's down from 2.6 20 years ago.
Yes.
So it's interesting. So, yeah. So that is correct.
We need to take a short station break, and we'll be back with Business Game Changers on the Conscious Business Radio Network in a moment. Welcome back to Business Game Changers, and I'm talking with Irvin Goldman, and we will continue the interview now.
Well, that's going to have major impacts. So how do you think technology is going to change the way all this runs? Wall Street, the financial system.
I think Wall Street is going through it is only at the beginning of impact that technology will have in terms of transitioning the structure of the financial system. And the reason is, first of all, Wall Street firms, the major ones, were all vertically integrated, and they're based on all these archaic systems. And what you're seeing now is you're seeing all these technology companies looking at the way they do business and say, wow, that's really inefficient.
I went through that in the early 90s in telecommunications. Where we were ahead of the game there, but we were just so bad. And we called it re-engineering back in the day, but the other industries are going through that huge upheaval now.
Right. And I think we're just starting. So you see the initially in the form of these robo-advisors that are coming out in the asset management world. Right. And, offering much lower fee structures and the ability to basically take the mirage, if you will, of Wall Street's asset allocation model. Okay. And prove that, it's a very simple thing that a computer can do, to the idea of these, peer-to-peer lenders where, all of a sudden, the private sector is coming in to disintermediate the banking sector and allowing,
That's disruptive. It's interesting.
So you see on the front end, disruption to the business model. And on the back end, you're seeing people coming out with solutions where it makes it much easier, cheaper, and more efficient to do things, which will, quite frankly, reduce employment over time in technology. And it will change the way people are doing business. And it's interesting because, we're getting to the point where we're getting into the children of the baby boom, hitting their strides to be major part of the income producing, population. And they are at the beginning. They were at the beginning stage of, just the whole, the societal change and attitude towards the use of technology.
Yeah, they come in with just an assumption. Right. Whereas everybody else is trying to make it happen or fighting or whatever, they come in just saying, this is just the way it is, guys, let's move.
Right, and this should not be, and this is the way it is, and I'll use this, not that.
Yeah.
Right? So, and the class, it's not an exact parallel, but the financial system is just starting the process on the front end of being Uberized, as I say, right?
Yeah.
And in the back end, it's just going to become much more efficient. And, whether it's blockchain technology, just the world, it's just going to change. And
we're going to have bumps along the way, right? People taking advantage of things, doing criminal, weird stuff. And we're going to have to figure it out and get it out of there, core it out. We're going to have bumps along the way as people, just like we have viruses and we have hackers all over the place.
Listen, cybersecurity is a really scary issue.
It is.
And it doesn't matter what industry it relates to. It's scary, right? I mean,
We shut down Iran's nuclear program there's so many things that goes on in cyberspace. I have a cyber expert that comes on every few months, and it's amazing the stuff he tells us.
Right. I actually think what's going to cause probably one of the biggest panics in the future in the financial market is that there will be some kind of technological disruption that will so affect day-to-day living and the fear that all of a sudden the system just that we've relied on got taken down to a certain extent. I think that's the thing that will cause probably the biggest.
Well, do you think we have an? Do you think we have an issue with the fear of people in general? Because I think that ties into people not really understanding the world and the complexities, and with software and things. See, I have an edge because I designed, you know, the telecommunications industry from end to end. That's my background, is I have an engineering, computer science type background. And it gave me a really different perspective. And then I moved into business. But I see so much of this, you know, the conspiracy theories and stuff getting kind of weirdo. And I'm, you know, some of it is based in fact, and then they take it to an extreme. And there, you know, there can be real conspiracies can happen where people get together and strategize and do things, right? That's just how things work. But there's so much fear, I think, behind this. And I'm wondering, is that because of people just not understanding how all this works? And it's the same with, you know, with cyber warfare, which is extremely scary because that could really balloon out of control. And on top of this fear environment could really be a problem.
Well, it's interesting. I take a big macro view towards it. So the people that are least technologically sophisticated are baby boomers and beyond, right? So people in their 50s through, you know, I'm not saying mid-40s through and up. And what's interesting is that is the percentage of population that is, from a financially prudent standpoint, going to put more and more of their capital in safer and safer securities because they just can't afford to take the risk.
Exactly, yep.
So what's happening is the generations that are going to understand this the most are actually the generations that are the ones that are going to be investing in riskier assets as they should be. So it's an interesting dynamic as to what's going to happen in the future. I think right now we're still, you know, we're in the phase where, you know, it's almost like a little bit of shock and disbelief on the part of certain parts, certain generations as to, like, this is too overwhelming.
Yes.
Even comprehend. So. As opposed to the younger generations, which is, this is moving so fast.
That's
hard to keep up with.
And it's right? fun. Get, they think it's fun.
It is fun.
Yeah,
It is fun. I took there are these great online courses. I think there's one online course that I think everybody should take, which is, if they can, which is Harvard has a CS50 online course taught by David Matlin.
Yeah.
And it is just off the charts, both in its approach and a really, get to a really good understanding of computer science. And it's, in my view, the way every online educational system should be. But I just think it's something that, everybody should take.
If people understand computer science and the design of data across the world, you know, and servers and how it all flows, their understanding of the world today would be so much better. It would change our society quite a bit.
Right. And listen, you know, you saw that Mayor de Blasio in New York City is trying to put in force that that computer science is mandatory in schools for children. And I think that is great. And
it is. It should be a basic thing. It's like English.
Right. I'm more worried about people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s that are still going to be living, in theory. You know, the average age is, 78 and 82 now and going higher, right? So people have 20, 30 years, and we're, in my view, we're just at the beginning of the technology revolution.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
We haven't started with artificial.
I think we're in a new renaissance, kind of.
We totally are.
It's so awesome.
Right. But unfortunately, part of it creates massive social.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yep.
So there's, yep. It's the good and the bad.
There's, but, and we got to solve those problems too. If we're good, caring people, we got to look at making sure that we develop systems and our country and communities in a way that everyone can participate and be prosperous if they work hard.
Right. So that's why, you know, I didn't complete my thought. I'm sorry. But that's why I think the most important thing that could go on is for the people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s to actually get an education in computer science. I think that's the best thing people could do, because I think once you have a certain amount of knowledge, you will have a lot less fear.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And it's amazing how much you understand the world when you understand how that works.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been absolutely a pleasure talking to you today.
So it's been fabulous being with you.
How can people get hold of you? I know you do. Tell me what you do a little bit. We've talked all about this stuff. Let's hear what you do, because you have your own company now.
Right. So right now, I manage the family office, and I work with other people that have family offices. So we have a lot of dialogue. You know, I consult on fintech a bunch. And that's really what I've been doing. You know, I go on, I've gotten into social media, so I go on to a number of sites. I have certain blogs on validityholdings.com that people could see. But that's basically it. People could, you know, I'm in the social media a lot. I'm very available. When people email me, I always give them things.
You're a goldmine of expertise, because with your experience at the time, just – your experience on Wall Street and the time that you were there, you're just, you have a lot of knowledge in that noggin.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Well, good. Well, thank you. And I'll put your information up on my radio page.
Okay. Fabulous. Have a great weekend. Enjoy.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye, sir.
Well, thank you for joining me today on Business Game Changers. And if you have any comments or anything you want to make on this show or others, please go to my website at sarahwestall.com. And also, if you have any really great ideas for this show, make sure you let me know. I am always looking for the next big thing, disruption, and the big issues that we're trying to deal with right now. So if you have any of that, please send me a line on my email or put comments. It's all on my website at sarahwestall.com. And for now, everyone have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.